All right, next case is number 1598 of the 2023 term, William Thornton versus the State of Maryland. Counsel, come up and get yourselves ready. And Mr. Newton, whenever you're ready, you may begin.
Proceed.
Whenever you're ready, sir.
May it please the court. This morning, time permitting, I will address three issues raised in the briefs. First, whether there's sufficient evidence supporting Mr. Thornton's convictions of first-degree murder, conspiracy to commit murder, and the two related firearms convictions. Second, whether the district court violated the right to a public trial by sua sponte closing the courtroom over objection during two critical stages. First, the giving of an Allen charge, and then secondly, the return of the jury's verdict, including the polling of the jury. And third, whether the district court committed reversible plain error by admitting so-called expert testimony that the 9mm bullets recovered from the victim's body were fired by a Desert Eagle 9mm pistol that was recovered from Mr. Thornton's car.
Right. That's the abrupt.
Correct.
Got it.
Correct. That'll be my third issue. I'll begin with the insufficient evidence issues. When viewing the evidence in a light most favorable to the verdict, with all reasonable inferences made in that analysis, a rational jury could not have found two essential elements beyond a reasonable doubt. First, premeditation. And second, a conspiratorial agreement before the shooting began. As I said in the briefing, I will assume arguendo three things. First, that Mr. Thornton was one of the six men shown in the grainy video walking towards two men, including the victim, before the shooting happened. Second, that Mr. Thornton was the getaway car driver and fled from that getaway car after it crashed into a tree. And third, that Mr. Thornton's DNA, along with two other men's DNA, was on the Desert Eagle 9mm pistol. Mr. Clark and Mr. Dunbar were the other two. That evidence does not permit a rational jury to have found beyond a reasonable doubt either premeditation or a conspiratorial agreement among the men.
Why? There's six of them walking together, connected all these firearms to these guys. We can get arguments about the ballistics evidence and all that, but why at the sufficiency level can't the jury connect those dots?
Well, let's look at what...
I mean, six people don't just walk together randomly.
Oh, I don't suggest there wasn't some criminal activity that this would support, but we're talking about first-degree premeditated murder and conspiracy to commit premeditated murder, both of which have the same basic mens rea, premeditation
right.
before the fact.
Right.
Here's the problem. Unlike any other case that this court has ever decided, and I've argued other murder cases. I think I argued before you, Judge, last year in a case with video out of Baltimore, but it had a lot of clear video that showed exactly what the men did.
If you're talking about the Cleveland case, you're
correct.
Right. I mean, that's, but you could tell who people were in Cleveland, but otherwise, the theory of conspiracy is identical.
Oh, I don't think it's identical. It's not identical because, for instance, the gentleman I represented in that case, it showed him pulling a pistol out almost instantaneously when the other men started shooting. We don't know because there is grainy, silent video from a distance that does not show who did what. We don't know among the six.
No, but you have to get to that elsewhere. But you're making the sort of the upfront argument, right? Which is the same basic argument. And I don't know, Ms. Treister probably wasn't here at the time, but Ms. Rossi, who argued that case, got a hard time from me about how you could possibly have evidence of forming an agreement when you didn't have any text messages or any writings or any testimony from anybody about what they did beforehand. And yet, when you get back and you look at the video and you write the opinion, like, we had to come to grips with the fact that there was enough there. Now, you did have better video in Cleveland than
much better video.
But you have from a formation of purpose and intent and premeditation standpoint, you have all the same stuff here. And if you're, for purposes of your sufficiency argument, conceding that Mr. Thornton was among the crowd, and then you concede also in a footnote that we have to consider the inadmissible ballistics testimony for sufficiency purposes, then how are the dots not connected?
The dots are not connected.
For, again, this very low sufficiency bar.
Well, it's not a very low sufficiency
bar. It is.
No, it's not.
Any reasonable jury connect these dots? Now, they have to connect them beyond a reasonable doubt. It's true. But if you're conceding your guy's there, you're conceding that he and the group can be connected to the gun, how is it that the jury can't connect these dots?
Well, a couple of things. I'm not conceding anything. I assumed arguendo.
Fair enough. You're conceding for purposes of calculating the sufficiency of this evidence.
That's correct. Well, let me go back to a point you made. This is not a very low standard. Jackson versus Virginia and Winship imposes a requirement of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. That is a very high standard. Admittedly, when you're doing a sufficiency analysis, it's not like you're arguing to a jury. But appellate courts should not be blindly deferential to this standard. What we have here and how this differs so significantly from the Cleveland case is we do not know who was armed among the six men. We do not know who shot. And we don't have any kind of prior. And if you go back and look at the Cleveland facts, there was multiple clear angles of video showing the men had talked, the men waited, the men came forward, and then the other two men came. It was clearly a drug deal. We don't know anything about this case because other than just six men encountered two men, and in particular one man, and the shooting happened. Was this a robbery gone awry? We don't know.
We didn't know that in Cleveland either.
Well, but what we did know in Cleveland was we had very clear video showing precisely who did what and when, down to the split second. We don't know what was said.
We didn't know what was said in Cleveland either.
No, but you could make a lot of reasonable inferences based on the quality and the quantity. That this is a difference in kind, not degree, from Cleveland. There's just too much missing. And let me now turn to the pistol. The Desert Eagle pistol was handled by, or at least has DNA, by three men. Not two men, three men, including two of the other men in the car. The government's, or the state's own expert, said the following. We don't know what that shows us in terms of when it was possessed, how long ago it was possessed, whether it was fired by one of the three men whose DNA it was, or whether it was fired by somebody whose DNA was not on there. There's plenty of cases where people's DNA don't end up on an object. We are engaging and piling inference upon inference here, which is what the Supreme Court of the United States said decades ago you can't do to find sufficient evidence. There's simply too much of a gap here. There's simply too many inferences that you have to stack upon another. If it was only his DNA, I would not be arguing this. The fact that it's three people's DNA, it doesn't matter. The state tried to argue, well, he had more DNA or the probabilities were greater for him. None of that is what's in the evidence. It doesn't matter how much DNA or the fact there are three people's DNA completely guts proof beyond a reasonable doubt that he possessed the gun and shot the gun, even if you accept the bullets from the victim's body came from that gun. So what? It doesn't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt for Mr. Thornton. Now, as I said in my briefs, I'm not making an inconsistent verdict argument, but you cannot ignore the fact that the jury acquitted the other three people of murder and conspiracy and only convicted my client. That has to factor into your assessment of the rationality of the jury looking at the specific evidence. Because it makes no sense.
Well, they picked the guy who ended. What more of his DNA on the gun?
That would be a completely irrational basis to support the verdict. As I said, and as the state's own expert said, it doesn't matter whether there's a little DNA or a lot of DNA. That doesn't make it any more probable that he shot the gun or he possessed it.
It may not by itself, but it was also found in the same part of the car where he was driving, wasn't it?
No, Your Honor. It was found in the passenger compartment where Clark sat, and Clark's DNA was on that gun, too.
Okay.
Every one of these facts You have to just pile other inferences upon them to get to proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
What about the fact that the others had their own guns and rifles?
Well, the fact that there was multiple DNA from multiple people on multiple guns suggests that they all at some point handled other guns. One of the persons had two guns on him when he was arrested. You can't draw any inferences from any of that. You could draw inferences, and you didn't need to draw inferences in Cleveland. You could see who had what gun based on where cartridges were. There's no such evidence in this case. This is clearly distinguishable.
Same Abruqua problem, by the way. But
I'm sorry?
Had the same Abruqua problem, but...
Well, correct, but the Abruqua issue doesn't get the state anywhere in this case because of three people's DNA being on that gun. I want to turn quickly to the closure issues. The state does not dispute what happened. The only dispute in this case was the closure during de minimis proceedings or critical stages? An Allen charge where the courtroom was closed entirely from the public. There was nobody allowed in the room during the Allen charge. I submit that is the strongest argument I have. That is clearly a critical stage. It's a critical stage under the right to counsel. The state does not dispute me on that. The state says, well, the right to counsel and the right to a public trial, they're different rights for purposes of a critical stage analysis. I agree. But you know what? The right to a public trial is stronger in terms of a critical stage analysis for an Allen charge, and I'll tell you why. When you need an attorney, the right to counsel, it's to be able to defend yourself. The right to a public trial, it goes above that. The right to a public trial is about the jury knowing that there's sunshine from the public, but also the judge and the prosecutor. So the right to a public trial, and their case law says this, the right to a public trial is about making sure sunlight is in that courtroom so everybody does what they should do, and including the jury. The judge giving an Allen charge, the jury receiving an Allen charge, that's critical. That's really critical. An Allen charge is one of the most important things that could happen in a criminal case.
How do you respond to the state's preservation argument on all this?
This was preserved. The other one you could argue was not fully preserved. This one was fully preserved. There was repeated objections to closing the courtroom, and it was a sua sponte closure, I should add. Repeated objections.
Well, but it wasn't out of thin air either. I mean, there have been emotional outbursts during the trial on a number of occasions.
Correct. Right? Let me focus on the three things the judge says she closed the courtroom for.
I mean, it wasn't like the judge just kicked people out.
No. Let me talk about the three reasons the judge gave for closing the courtroom. One of them was a confrontation that happened outside the courthouse, nothing to do with something inside the courtroom, number one. Number two, one of the other co-defendants had a father who came up to one of the jurors. They apparently known each other from their childhood and said something about this is a bunch of crap or whatever. That was in the hallway. There was one and only one thing the judge pointed to that happened inside the courtroom itself. And that was a person anonymously who took a cell phone photo and posted it on Instagram. Closing the courtroom because of that would have been drastically overdone. There are plenty of alternative measures to closing the courtroom for that. You could have done a metal detector, whatever. I mentioned sua sponte.
You kick out that person?
I'm sorry?
You kick out the photographer?
Of course, if you could determine who that was. We deal with courtroom cell phones all the time. You don't close the courtroom because of that. So this was clearly an unjustified sua sponte closure during a critical stage of the proceeding. And this is a structural error. There is no harm analysis here. The Supreme Court of the United States has said this repeatedly. This is a structural error. The convictions this affects are all of them. This is not simply an insufficient evidence about counts 1, 2, 8, and 9. This is everything. In my remaining time, I want to talk about the Abruqua era. I may be mispronouncing the case name.
I think that's the best we have.
This is plain error, but I will say it's plain error. It's really close to not being plain error because there was a timely motion for a new trial that was filed just as soon as the case came out and the judge addressed the merits of the issue. So this is not one where the court has to speculate for the first time on appeal about something. The trial judge did rule on this issue, denied the motion for a new trial. So we have
What were the grounds?
Well, there are multiple grounds. This was one of them. The Abruzzo case was cited in the motion for
new trial. I get it. But like, why did the court deny the Abruzzo motion for new trial? The reason we care about preservation normally is because we want the court to have an opportunity to solve a problem rather than have it hang over an otherwise appropriate proceeding.
Of course.
Okay, so that didn't happen during the trial itself. Why does a motion for new trial save it?
It at least lets you know how the judge would have ruled, and the judge denied it at least in part on the merits, not because it was being raised at the juncture it was being raised at. The testimony of the state's expert was that the bullets from the victim's body came from the Desert Eagle pistol. Not just were consistent, but were from that pistol. This is classic Abruzzo error.
No, we'll see what Ms. Treacer has to say, but I don't think there's any serious doubt that the testimony itself flunks Abruzzo. The question is whether the error is cognizable in the life of this case.
All right. I'm happy to address that or save that for rebuttal.
Okay.
I had a question about
Judge Albright.
Are there any cases since Abruzzo where we have actually done plain error review on Abruzzo errors?
I ran that last night, actually, on Westlaw. There's some unpublished decisions in which this court has been faced with that error. But the court has done one of two things. One line of cases, the court has said that it's not plain, that it was an error, but it's not plain. And I have addressed that issue in my brief, which is the United States Supreme Court in Henderson, which is the court that originally announced the Olano standard, which the Maryland courts have adopted. In Henderson, the Supreme Court said it can become plain based on something that supersedes the law at trial by the time of appeal, and we clearly have that. Abruzzo happened. So I contend there was an error. I don't think anybody disputes there's an error. The question is it plain? It's plain based upon Abruzzo. And then the third and the fourth prongs are, is it affect the substantial rights, and is this something the court should exercise its discretion to fix? And the third standard, I would say, yes, indeed it's substantial, because you know why the jury convicted my client and acquitted the other ones? Because of the 9mm pistol evidence that they say linked it to him, and the bullets linked it to the killing. That at least is certainly the most rational way to read this record. So it affected his substantial rights, and considering the fact that the co-defendants were acquitted, I would ask this court to exercise its discretion. This is a rare case in that regard.
But are there other... I've found a handful of these cases. There's Stevens, Jennifer, where I was on the panel for that. I think it was Justice Rager. Cleveland was your case. I can't say I found all of them. But were any of them ones in which there were multiple defendants, co-defendants?
Yes, Cleveland.
Cleveland was. Okay.
Yes, but I don't think I represented one of the co-defendants, and I don't think I argued that case. I think it was specific to...
Not everybody in Cleveland made the argument, and there were some differences across whether the Abruzzo issue was attached to different defendants.
But has there ever been an unreported case since Abruzzo where we have exercised plain error review on Abruzzo?
No, because you've cut it off at step two, and I'm asking the court to follow the Supreme Court's line of the Supreme Court's decision in Henderson, not cut it off at step two and turn to step three and four. And this is an appropriate case for that.
So this would be the first time?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Treacer?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Kristen Treacer for the state. First, I want to push back on this notion that the court made an error on the firearms evidence, either plain at the time of trial or plain at the time of appeal. And the reason I say that, Your Honors, is because Abruzzo, if you read the opinion, and I know this court is very familiar with it, the Supreme Court made an effort to emphasize that its finding in Abruzzo was based on the record in Abruzzo. It explicitly left open the possibility that the state in another case might be able to come up with sufficient research, sufficient testimony, sufficient expert evidence to make a finding that the firearms matching is scientific reliable and therefore admissible. By not asking the trial judge to hold a Rauschenbusch-Daubert hearing, the defense prohibited the state from having that opportunity. So the error here, if there was an error, and my point is I'm not even conceding error, because at the time of trial, Abrucco was up in the air. Nobody really knew where it was going to land. Yes, Your Honor, you're...
Well, I just am trying to figure out which part of the error you're not conceding. I mean, the testimony itself flunks Abrucco.
My point, Your Honor...
I just want to make sure I'm understanding where you're differing.
Sure.
Are you focusing on the not settled law element of this? That the question of ballistics expert evidence was sufficiently unsettled that it can't possibly rise to plain error for that purpose? Or are you saying, no, actually, this was appropriate ballistics evidence?
I'm not saying it was appropriate. What I'm saying is that we don't know that it was inappropriate because the state was never given the opportunity to prove its reliability.
How could the state possibly have proven that given what we know about Abrucco?
Your Honor, Abrucco was very specifically decided on the record in Abrucco.
I know, but how can one read that case and come out of that thinking that there's a record on which an expert could say, oh yeah, that bullet came from that gun?
Well,
you think there's an opportunity after Abrucco for a ballistics expert to render testimony with that kind of certainty?
Well, certainly the state would have to present research that was not presented in Abrucco. But if the state could come up with studies that show a more reliable testing method than the one used that was presented in the Abrucco case, the Supreme Court specifically left open the possibility that the state could prove it was reliable.
Is there a case anywhere that uses a different and more reliable testing methodology that would survive this hypothetical?
I am not suggesting that it has been proven reliable. I'm saying that it might be proven reliable with different research.
You know, my daughter might get a pony for Christmas too. I mean, what? Anything's possible, I guess. But you're saying that the state should have had the opportunity in a Rauschenbusch-Daubert hearing to offer a theory of ballistics that nobody in Maryland or anywhere to your knowledge has proven that would support the admission of this ballistics evidence?
Not a theory, Your Honor, but research. The point...
I know, but you don't know... I mean, this is super hypothetical. You're positing the possibility of research that doesn't exist anywhere in our knowledge.
Within the court's knowledge, that's true.
Or yours.
Or mine, that's true also.
Okay, so...
But that doesn't mean it's not out there.
Well... I would...
We'll never know if we're not, Your Honor. If the defense is not required to ask for Rauschenbusch-Daubert hearings, the state will never be able to produce new research. Let's say there's
research.
Look,
this is only going to be a problem during the window of time between cases that were tried before Abrucco was decided and are still alive on appeal after Abrucco was decided.
I disagree with that, Your Honor.
Because after Abrucco was decided, then everybody knows, right, if you have your trial after whatever the date of Abrucco is, then, right, everybody knows what states and the both sides have got to have the right to put on or not put on and what the line of attack is. This problem we have with the preservation or not of Abrucco really only applies to the universe of cases, and it may not be just a couple, but whatever, the universe of cases between trials that happened before Abrucco that are but nevertheless are still alive on direct appellate review when Abrucco was decided, right?
I disagree with that, Your Honor.
Why?
And because if we follow that reasoning, the state will never have the opportunity to prove the reliability of this firearms evidence. The holding in Abrucco, which the Supreme Court made an effort to emphasize, was specific to the Abrucco record, will become the general law in Maryland, because nobody will ever be forced to ask for a Rajkind Daubert hearing, and the state will never be provided the opportunity to prove the reliability of this evidence.
Why wouldn't you ask for it in every case after a Brugler? There are going to be murder cases cases involving guns that are going to be tried in the time since a Brugler was decided, right? Probably
yes.
Many of them already happened.
Right.
And if the state wants to put on ballistics evidence that is more certain than a Brugler allows, state's got every opportunity now to try that. If this hypothetical research exists somewhere in the world, you'll find it. Your colleagues in the local state's attorney's offices will find it. They'll bring it. The experts will bring it. It'll be whatever it is. But the state has every opportunity to do that. The window of time where this is murkier is where nobody knew that Brugler was going to be a Brugler until it got decided, and these trials happened before. You're saying the prejudice to the state is the lack of an opportunity to hypothesize research that nobody knows exists back at the time of a trial before a Brugler was decided.
I'm not suggesting that the state should have been allowed to hypothesize anything. I'm suggesting the state should have been allowed to present it. And there have been cases since Abruqua, and actually in Abruqua, the assistant attorney general who argued that case provided more research studies that the Supreme Court decided that they couldn't consider because it hadn't been raised in the circuit court.
Okay, so those get – in all the post-Abruqua cases, that's all there to be used. That's fine. That doesn't.
I guess I'm coming from a position, Your Honor. I have.
Are you saying that after Abruqua, all that stuff's going to get rejected out of hand because of Abruqua, and so your opportunity to do better than Abruqua ends with the cases decided or tried before that?
I think where I'm stumbling, Your Honor, is I've never heard of the state asking for a Rajkind-Daubert hearing. It's the defense who wants to challenge the state's expert.
So then why is the deprivation of the state's opportunity to have a hearing in this case an issue we should be concerned about?
Because the state wasn't given the opportunity to
I know, but if the state never does it, then why does it matter? You just said post-Abruqua, the state's never going to ask for this because it's always the defense. I guess where I'm getting confused is, after Abruqua, if it's true that there might be some opportunity to prove ballistics evidence with a greater degree of certainty than Abruqua allowed, state's got that opportunity to bring in that expert anytime it wants, right?
Are you suggesting that the state should be requesting Rajkind hearings?
No, not necessarily, but I guess maybe I'm just missing your point. You're saying that the state was deprived of an opportunity to have the hearing in this case.
Right.
But, of course, the state wouldn't have asked for it in the first place. The state was going to put on its expert anyway. Then what I thought you were saying is, well, no, the state might have established that there's research that supports more certainty on ballistics evidence than Abruqua allowed.
Right.
And my answer to that is, sure, that's possible, even if none of us knows what that is. But that possibility is available to the state now and forever, even with Abruqua out there, right? Because, as you say, Abruqua left open the possibility that there could be more research. So I'm struggling to understand what the state's been deprived. If you say the state isn't normally going to need to do a Rajkind-Daubert hearing because it's going to put on whatever expert and the defense is going to challenge that, that makes sense to me. What is it that the state was deprived of in the life of this case if the state's not normally going to be asking for that hearing anyway?
And that's exactly my point. The state doesn't prove the reliability of its scientific evidence in the course of trial in front of a jury. If the defense wants to challenge the reliability of scientific evidence, it files for a Rajkind-Daubert hearing.
It's true, but the state has the burden of proof. If the state comes with an expert, the state might not ask for a preemptive Daubert hearing. I get that. But the state's got to present the witness. The state's got to demonstrate the witness's qualifications. The state's got to satisfy Rule 5702.
Right.
The state's got to satisfy all of the sub-issues that, subsections 1, 2, and 3, and all of the Daubert-Rajkind factors. So the state's got the affirmative burden on all of that.
but it establishes the reliability of the evidence for admissibility purposes. I'm not talking about proof purposes, but for admissibility purposes, the state proves the reliability of scientific evidence at the Daubert-Rauschkein hearing. So if the defense never requests a hearing, the state, everybody assumes that we're agreeing this evidence is reliable. Now, whether
but
it's
that's not that's not necessarily. I mean, it's, you could have you could have a lawyer without a Daubert hearing challenge, ask to voir dire the witness in front of the jury, and challenge the admissibility of that expert's testimony ahead of during the trial.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I've never heard of such a thing.
Okay.
But if I'm more than halfway done my time, if I could move on to the other issues. For the closure of the courtroom during jury deliberations, and I do agree that for during jury deliberations, the defense did object. I'm not arguing preservation for the closure during deliberations. But the Sixth Amendment does not apply to occasions as de minimis as these jury deliberations. So it's an unresolved question in Maryland whether the Sixth Amendment right to a public trial ever applies to jury deliberations and the questions and the answers to them. But I would suggest that this is not the case to figure that out, because the specific facts of this case make them so de minimis that the Sixth Amendment would not apply anyway. And the reason I say that is because, you know, Kelly gives us three considerations about what makes something de minimis. The first is the length of the closure, and Kelly found that approximately 3 hours of jury selection was de minimis. Here we have six questions, and I know one of the defendants, and I don't remember which one it was, wrote that the closure lasted for several days. But this was during deliberations, so nothing was happening in the courtroom for the vast majority of that period of time. What we're really talking about is the amount of time that the judge spent answering the jury's questions. And four of those six questions were purely administrative. What time are we going home? We have a verdict, that kind of stuff. So we're really left with two questions, the time that the court spent answering two questions, which I would – and it's not in the transcript. The stenographer didn't note times when the court resumed and recessed. But I would suggest to the court that given the brevity of the answers – given the lack of any objection to any of the answers, given the lack of discussion or alternative proposals or any kind of conversation about these answers, the total time the court spent in providing the jury with these two answers was probably less than 30 minutes. I think that's very reasonable, although, you know, like I said, I can't figure out exactly from the transcript. But
why is time, the length of time, important? I mean, we're talking about an Allen charge.
Well, we're the time I list because it's one of the Kelly factors that says the court should consider. The Allen charge would go towards the second thing, which is the nature of the proceedings. And again, if the Allen charge had been contested, if it had been debated, if somebody had proposed different wording, then that may or may not make it more significant. But in this case, the court proposed the Allen charge. All four defendants agreed that the Allen charge should be given. As far as I can tell, the court gave the pattern Allen-type charge that the Supreme Court of Maryland has approved, and there was no objection to it. So this was not the case where legal arguments are made, where the judge has to make a decision. And the Allen-type charge was given on the afternoon of the third day of deliberations. So it's pretty pro forma at that late in the stage of deliberations that any judge confronted with a note that the jury is hung is going to give an Allen charge. This wasn't, you know, a half an hour into deliberations or sometime when it might be more of a decision to make. This was almost a check the box. You know, 3 days into deliberations, the jury says they're hung, we give an Allen-type charge. So there were no legal decisions made. There certainly was no objection made. The defense, all four of them, agreed that the Allen charge should be given. So based on that, and I point the court to Gibbons, I think, is closest, where they said specifically, and that, of course, related to voir dire, but they said specifically there were no objections made, there were no decisions made, nobody was stricken, therefore it was de minimis. And if we look at the purposes of having an open courtroom that the Supreme Court went over in Waller, none of that applies here. We don't have witnesses who need to be encouraged to testify. We don't have witnesses who need to be encouraged not to commit perjury. We don't have police misconduct that might be exposed without any legal argument or objections or discussion on what's happening. There's no legal decisions that the court has to ensure are being, you know, open to the public. There's no opportunity, like in voir dire, for the public to help the defense in picking jurors. Just none of the factors that Waller considered when it said suppression hearings should be open, none of that applies here. There's simply... there is no effect that a public presence could have had on the actions of the court or the prosecutor, who I don't think had any role in these proceedings other than to be there. So for those reasons, Your Honor, this is not the case to decide whether the Sixth Amendment applies to jury questions and answers to them. And finally, on sufficiency, I'll be very, very brief. My colleague has a good point about my confusion on the DNA evidence. I don't know where my mind was when I said higher probability meant that Mr. Thornton was more likely in possession. That's my mistake, and I apologize for it. But it does not affect the fact that Mr. Thornton's DNA was, in fact, on that gun. And the other two people whose DNA was on that gun had their own guns. So it does not take a leap of faith or any amount of speculation to come to the rational inference that the gun belonged to or was used by Mr. Thornton. And the fact that it was in the passenger's footwell, I think, is irrelevant, because if you are in a hurry to get away from someplace and you jump into the driver's seat of your car, whatever's in your hand, you're going to toss on the passenger seat. And if there's a passenger in that seat, you're going to toss it at their feet. It's just, it's where you throw things when you're in very much of a hurry to go somewhere. So I don't see any hurdle with the fact that the gun was in the footwell of the passenger seat. Does the court have any questions? I know there are two issues that neither my colleague nor I addressed. Does the court have any questions on any of it?
I don't. I think not.
Thank you, Your Honor. Then with that, I would ask the court to affirm Mr. Thornton's convictions, and I would submit.
All right. Mr. Easter. Mr. Newton, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you. I'll take it in the order that my colleague addressed the issues, the third issue first, the appropriate issue. I'm trying to understand the logic that applying plain error here would somehow give a free pass forever for lawyers to not object in the future to these issues. I don't understand it.
I don't know that she was actually making that argument. I think she was saying more that the error was not so plain, that that state might have had an opportunity to demonstrate that this testimony wasn't out of bounds, even under Rubruqua, and that in any case, going back to your colloquy with Judge Albright, there are some other cases where we have declined to exercise plain error review, including Cleveland, although that laid out a little differently than this one. On this particular question. So, I mean, Ms. Treister and I never got sort of, I think, too far down the plain error analysis path. Because I think she was arguing more that this isn't necessarily even an error, let alone a plain one.
Well, I think in doing a plain error analysis in appellate court, I mean, one could always say, if there had been an objection, who knows how things would have gone. But that only goes so far. If you take that logic, I mean, reductio ad absurdum, that would gut plain error entirely. What we do know here is we have unequivocal testimony from a supposed expert that these bullets from the body match this pistol, coupled with the government arguing, oh, his DNA's on the pistol, and for all the other reasons, he had to have been the one who shot the pistol. That's a pretty important fact issue that turns upon expert testimony that appears to be on all fours with what was in a Brooklyn. The other thing I want to keep pointing out is there was a motion for a new trial here. And what that at least does is, if the court were to announce a rule, I think it's a fair thing to note there was a motion for a new trial.
Yeah, tell me how this helps you.
It helps because it shows the lawyer acted quickly upon the law changing. Plain error is equitable. The plain error exception is equitable. It's discretionary. There's no fixed reversal requirement. It's within the conscience of the court. And when one of the classic principles of equity is a lawyer doesn't sit on their hands, or party doesn't sit on their hands. They act quickly. And we have a lawyer, defense lawyer, who did act quickly and asked for a motion for a new trial. Trial judge disagreed, denied it. At least we have some idea of what the trial judge would have done had there been a timely objection before a court. That is an equity that militates in favor of application of the plain error standard here, which would, I'm sure, distinguish it from the vast majority of those pipeline cases that Your Honor talked about. And I want to, again, focus on the second prong. I think the main reason that this court in unpublished decisions has denied relief has been, at least in some of these cases, it has been that the error was not plain at the time of trial. I strongly urge you to apply the Supreme Court of the United States decision in Henderson, which recognizes for plain error purposes an error can become plain for the second prong of the Alano standard for the first time on appeal. It makes no sense to adopt the Supreme Court's Alano jurisprudence and ignore that subsequent decision applying the Alano jurisprudence. So that, I believe, will help distinguish some of the prior panel decisions. The other factor we have, I know at least one of those other panel decisions was it was not clear testimony like there was in this case in Abruqua that, oh, that gun, that bullet came from that gun. We have that unquestionably, that's what the record shows in this case. So I strongly urge this panel to grant relief on that issue, which would affect counts 1, 2, 8, and 9. The closure issue. The government argues that this was not a critical stage. This was de minimis because there was no dispute about the Allen charge. I'm not arguing there was a dispute about the Allen charge. I'm not arguing the public would have in any way, you know, caused the lawyers to act differently about objecting to the Allen charge. I'm arguing the effect the public would have had on the judge and the jury during an Allen charge. We know an Allen charge is a very dangerous thing. It can really, it can have a huge impact on jury. It can coerce a verdict. That's the Supreme Court's language. The whole point of the public trial right is to make sure that we have as much public visibility, transparency, and if the length of time doesn't matter. If it's a critically important point, even if it takes a minute, the public trial right applies. To argue that, oh, you have to have a lot of time, and I understand that was one of the factors in Kelly. Kelly didn't deal with an Allen charge. This is a special application of the right to a public trial to it, and by its nature, a very short but incredibly important part of the proceedings that should have had the public sunlight.
All right. Thanks, you both. The case is submitted. We're going to take a short